Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the most exciting time on internet radio. It is the one and only Scarycast. So glad to have everyone here with us. This is Dr. John Stamey, live from Myrtle Beach. We've got a full cast of co-hosts and one of our best guests ever. He comes on the first Monday of every month. So we're glad to have him, John LeMay from Roswell, New Mexico. And first of all, I'd like to introduce our panelists from Pop Culture Stars. Here is Todd Saxon. How are you tonight, Todd?
I am doing outstanding to supernatural and ecstatic to be here. Hope everyone is doing well also.
Buddy, you're pretty supernatural. That's all I've got to say. And the Surgeon General of Scarycast, the one and only Dr. Trey Donaway. How are you doing, Dr. Trey?
I'm doing fine, John. Happy to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you here, and it's going to be exciting. And, of course, our man from Hollywood, Devin Tate. What's going on, buddy, out there in the most exciting place in the world? What's going on in Hollywood?
It's a beautiful day here, a bright and shiny day, so no complaints here.
Well, that's great. Tonight we've got one of our favorite guests. He comes on the first Monday of every month. It is the one and only John LeMay. John, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, I'm doing great. It's beautiful here in Roswell, all clouds and no UFOs, and everything was great.
No UFOs? What's wrong with Roswell tonight?
Yes, guys, you're clear.
Oh, okay. Well, that's all right. We might get some before the show's over. I can tell that. Well, tonight, John always gives us some pre-show stuff to talk about, and I want to read it because it's very, very interesting. We've got a super show tonight, and John's going to tell you why it's exciting. But here's what his notes were. Godzilla, the King of the Monsters, of course, was released in November of 1954 with an all-Japanese cast. In 1956, it was acquired by Transworld Pictures, and new scenes with Raymond Burr, pre-Perry Mason, were added in. Now, do people remember Raymond Burr? He was considered one of the great actors in, I'd say, the early part of Hollywood and the early part of television, which would be about from 1945 up through 1965. He was a megastar, and you might remember him also playing that dramatic role of the detective in the wheelchair,
Lawyer.
Ironsides. So anyway, what a great actor. So anyway, the movie was retitled Godzilla, King of the Monsters, in the movie that they had added scenes with Raymond Burr. It became a huge, gigantic success. Well, next came Godzilla Rides Again in Japan in 1955. And that was actually, it came along right before the American movie Godzilla came out. And it was remade into Gigantus, the fire monster, in 1959, but was simply just dubbed into English. For some reason, they renamed it Godzilla Gigantus. Well, you know, whatever. Toho Films was doing whatever they wanted to, and they were making a ton of money with the Godzilla franchise. Now, let's come up to this year and this month, or actually last month. King Kong versus Godzilla was originally shot with an all-Japanese cast and had new American actors added to it for its U.S. release. It was the last film to do so until Godzilla 1985, released in the same year of the title, which again had Raymond Burr. Now, so exciting. So first of all, John, it's great to have you here. Can you give us a brief overview of Godzilla versus King Kong? And I know who my favorite is. Who's your favorite?
Well, Godzilla's my favorite, but just to be clear, are we going to talk about the new movie a little bit right now? Is that what we're talking about, the one that just came out, right? We're talking about that one?
Sure. Why not?
Yeah, you know, it was really good. I'm more of a Godzilla person, but I rooted for King Kong because he was kind of propped up as the hero of that movie. And it's one of those movies that made me smile from ear to ear the whole time, but it's also incredibly dumb. It's a really dumb movie. But it's actually doing really well as a movie can do, you know, when theaters run at full capacity. People are actually pretty surprised by it. I don't think it would be doing this well, honestly, if people weren't starved for entertainment. You know, I think the country's at like a boiling point and people just finally want to get back out there. And this is like the big movie that's out when theaters are finally starting to reopen. So I think that's why it's doing so well. Had it come out, you know, just back in regular times, pre-COVID, I don't think it'd be a big deal, but it's really actually generating a lot of hype just because people are excited for it. And it's also, I think it was kind of refreshing for people too, because there's zero politics in it at all. And I think people really like that because they're so tired of being bludgeoned over the head with that and all the different forms of entertainment. So again, it's doing really, really well. And,
I guess we might say that this success is situational. Would you say that?
Yes, absolutely. Because, again, it's such a dumb movie. I mean, it's fun, but it's really dumb. I don't think people would have just fallen in love with it. But it's just, you know, people are ready to get out of the house and go back to movie, you know, theaters. And, it's just the right time.
John, this is Trey. Do you think that that in this new movie, and I was going to watch it last night, and I just ran out of time, so I have not seen it yet. But would you say that it stays true to the Godzilla roots? Because certainly, if anybody should be able to talk about the roots of Godzilla, it's you. Does it stay true to it, or does Hollywood do what it often does? It just kind of changes things significantly, and it's a different story.
No, so all three of Legendary Pictures Godzilla movies have been pretty true to the character. And Legendary, in the first two Godzilla movies they did, really painted Godzilla as an overt hero. You know, and in the Japanese movies, he would go back and forth between hero and villain. But what's interesting about Godzilla versus Kong is they don't portray him as an outright hero. He's really the villain of the movie. And again, that's, you really root for King Kong, and you want Kong to beat Godzilla because he's just kind of a jerk the whole movie. So in that sense, you could say Godzilla goes back to his roots of being, less likable.
But they didn't paint him blue or red. Both Godzilla Kong are purple, I guess. So that it's apolitical.
Yeah. They're purple in the sense that they fight in Hong Kong at the end, and there's all these purple lights kind of reflecting on their skin. But again, totally non-political movie, and I think people really appreciate that.
Yeah, I think everybody is tired of politics.
Yeah, and I'll note that here in California, you know, our in Hollywood, the famous Chinese theater that tons of people know has been closed for over a year now, and it just reopened last week, and that's the first movie that it's showing. So it's kind of a cool thing to welcome back to Chinese theater with Godzilla versus Kong.
And Devin, I think that King Kong 1933 was premiered at Grauman's Chinese Theater. Does that sound right?
That it sounds right. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'd have to check, but I think so.
Yeah.
Such an amazing, amazing history. Well, I've got one question that comes right to mind. Do you think that the popularity of King Kong has anything to do with the popularity, especially today, of Bigfoot? Because we got a big dude, you know, that's 12, 13, or 14 feet tall, and so King Kong's just a bigger version of that. Do you think somehow that people superimpose Bigfoot on top of King Kong?
Well, that could be. I do know that there was a movie called Bigfoot, I think made in the 2000s, and when it got released in India, they renamed it King Kong 3. which I think is kind of funny. So there's definitely some parallels between King Kong and Bigfoot. There's a lot of King Kong ripoff films that star Sasquatch-type creatures, like they did one in 1977 called Yeti, Giant of the 20th Century. It's a really good little film. I enjoy it. So yeah, there's definitely some cross-pollination between King Kong and Sasquatch, but I don't know if I'd say that's why I think he's popular, though. I don't think so. I think it's just he's just a likable character, I think.
Well, in that relationship, you could have the parallels between Lizard Man and certainly Lizard Man and Godzilla.
Oh, that we should have done a knockoff like Asylum to capitalize on this, and we should have made Lizard Man versus King Kong.
Well, yeah, a Lizard Man.
I mean, I'm sorry,
yeah.
Lizard Man
versus Sasquatch, or Lizard Man versus Bigfoot.
Yeah.
Although I would think they would get together and help each other out.
Yeah.
Thank you for that analysis, Trey. We love Lizard Man. Lizard Man, in my opinion, is an overriding good guy. He may have had his moments, but he's an overriding good guy. We're just glad that he's around. We'll have to see what we can do. We've got to get Reggie Fullwood back on because Reggie had a Lizard Man film that was shut down. He was paid a lot of money, and they're going to remake the film next year. So I've still got his phone number, and I'll have to have him back on here, and he can tell us. I think he'd be a little more free to tell us about what all has been going on with that franchise. So that would be a kind of a neat thing to do to find out really what's going on with Lizard Man. But yes, you know, I think we've got a great thing with Godzilla and King Kong. Now, John, what type of insight can you give us as we look back from the 1950s franchise and that great Raymond Burr film? I know it was a remake, a recut of what they did, but God, it was a good film. What can you tell us about that film?
Yeah, so a lot of, the diehard Godzilla fans know this, but casual fans, it just kind of, maybe they saw it on TV once or something when they were kids, are totally unaware that Godzilla, 1954, Gojira, as the Japanese call it, and Godzilla, King of the Monsters, 1956, are basically different movies based on the same source material. You know, Toho Studios in Japan, when they made Godzilla in 1954, I don't know if they ever dreamed of it actually getting exported to America. You know, Japanese films weren't really being exported to America because there were still a lot of tensions and prejudices carrying over from World War II. So they just didn't really want to do Japanese films in America. But in Godzilla's case, it was a big hit in Japan, number one. And number two is giant monster movies were really popular then. Actually, a reason for this, big reason, is King Kong got a theatrical re-release in 1952, which was really popular. And that kind of led to the creation of Beast from 20,000 Fathoms by Ray Harryhausen, which in turn in Japan inspired Godzilla. So again, in America, these giant monster movies were becoming really popular. And I can't remember who it was that saw the Japanese version of Godzilla. And he said, you know, I should bring this to America. And I think the first person to do that, his idea was to just simply put it in subtitles and release it. And he ended up selling it to some other producers who had the idea. Instead of subtitles or even just dubbing it into English, they thought, well, we really need an American star to anchor this movie, so why don't we just write a new character and whole new scenes and just integrate this brand new character into the film. And so they created the character of a reporter named Steve Martin. And, of course, this was for the comedian Steve Martin was a thing. You know, this was back in 1956. So the name thing wasn't an issue back then. And so what they did is they would have Steve Martin, the character played by Raymond Burr, they would have him interact with body doubles of the Japanese cast because they couldn't afford to, like, they weren't going to sink so much money into this movie that they were going to get the stars of Godzilla from Japan to fly to Los Angeles where they shot this thing. You know, so they would just kind of cleverly edit footage from Godzilla, you know, edit those actors into scenes with Raymond Burr, and like they'd have him stand in front of someone from behind, and it was very skillfully done. And you really, if you don't know any better, you think that he is talking to the characters from the movie just because it's so well done. And so, you know, they made like an alternate version of Godzilla just through the magic of editing, and it's really interesting. They did cut the movie down quite a bit. Godzilla King of the Monsters is actually quite a bit shorter than Godzilla. I think they removed, I have my notes here in front of me, I can tell you just how much footage they removed from the original Japanese version. So the Japanese version ran 96 minutes, the U.S. version ran 80 minutes, so that means, and they added 20 minutes worth of footage starring Raymond Burr, so that means they actually cut out 38 minutes of the original Godzilla to make Godzilla King of the Monsters. And, you know, it's probably a good thing that they did. It made it more palatable to American audiences, and it was a huge hit. I think it grossed about $2 million in the U.S. So for a Japanese-made film to do that back then, that was you know, a landmark success, really.
Wow. I mean, you know, what more can you say? Really. Now, in terms of Raymond Burr, one of our panelists, Devin Tate, has some stories about the home of Raymond Burr. Do you remember that episode where you told us all about that?
Yeah, I was wondering if you remembered. I couldn't remember if I had mentioned it before, but
recount the story, everybody, right now?
Yeah. Well, so my friend, one of my best friends, actually was the caretaker, the live-in caretaker of that house about 5 years ago. So it was originally, I think Raymond Burr was the second owner of the house, but he lived there throughout most of his time as an actor. So while he was in Hollywood, that was his home, and it was a pretty big house when he had it. But then he sold it in the 80s, and it was purchased by Miles Copeland from IRS Records. He's the brother of Stuart Copeland from the band The Police. And he was a very successful record producer, manager, and he added on to the house considerably. He built a whole another level up above what was the house. And it kind of had this ramshackle quality because there didn't seem to be a lot of thought into like where they were going to add things on. It just kind of kept going and going. So it was a really interesting old house up in the Hollywood Hills. I believe it was originally owned by one of the publishers of the Hollywood Citizen newspaper. So it does have a long, you know, varied history. But we did try to, I tried to do some ghost hunting in there. I don't know if I knew what I was doing really at the time, but it definitely felt like it was haunted. So that's why we were trying to do some paranormal tests. I wish I would have had somebody from ScaryCast to help me because I really just had downloaded some apps on my phone and tried. But it's definitely a creepy place, and it's on a hillside. So it's got you walk up the hill, and there's different greenhouses where Raymond Burr had all his orchids. And he apparently actually came up with – he bred his own varieties of orchids that are still, you know, named after him and – you know, his varieties that he invented, basically. So a lot of history there, a lot of cool stuff, but it also had a pretty eerie vibe.
Now, is it still possible to get into the house?
The house is still there. It's been purchased by another film producer. He was one of the producers of the movie. I think it was Independence Day, but I'd have to double check. But he's a movie producer, but what he's done is he bought that house, but it's on a huge lot on a hillside, like I said, and he's been evening out a portion up on the top of the hill, and I think what he wants to do is build a new house up on the higher part, and then I don't know if he's going to sell off the original Raymond Burr house or maybe he'll keep both of them, but it's just been kind of sitting there in a state of decay, And I believe they always have a live-in caretaker to just kind of make sure it's not falling down. But it's not in good shape. It's in bad shape, but it's still standing.
Well, I tell you what, our plan is to get out there in the latter part of the summer with William H. Cox and John LeMay, and then to come on over to Los Angeles. So see if you can get a hold of those folks, and we would love – I can bring my ghost box, and we can see if we can't do a real live ghost hunt and see if we can talk to Raymond Burr. I mean, I don't care what anyone says. Those ghost boxes work. And so see what you can do, and we'll talk about it. And we could do probably a two-part ScaryCast episode out there at the Raymond Burr house. So just do whatever you can, okay?
Yeah, that would be great.
All right, well, good. Now I want to go back to John LeMay. We got something very important to talk about. I told him about this legendary story about, I guess, a week and a half ago, and he said, wow. I said, but what about the veracity? What about the truth of this story? Do you have any question? And John LeMay said, John, if you tell it to me, then it's something that I can consider true. John LeMay, do you remember that conversation?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so here's the story. And believe it or not, this was told to me by Harry Medved. He and his brother Michael wrote two books. I've got copies of them right here next to me. One was the Golden Turkey Awards, and one was the Hollywood Hall of Shame. These were the precursors to the Raspberry Awards, which are awards for bad filmmaking. But here's what, I think this is an important quote. It was so important that I wrote it down, and this came directly from Harry Medved, and it came, the conversation that I had was in July the 6th, 1990. That's 31 years ago, almost 31 years ago. And I said, Harry, what's a bad movie? And he said, it's a movie where the director's intent was a serious work, but it ended up being a comedy, unintentionally. And we've seen a lot of those because we attribute many of the works of Ed Wood to be exactly that. He intended to make the greatest films in the world, but they turned out to be kind of funny and they're kind of bad, especially Glenn or Glenda, I Changed My Sex. Might not be. The fact is, he was very knowledgeable about Hollywood. And I said, and I came up with this question, and I was very serious because I absolutely adore the film Godzilla, 1956. And I said, Harry, wasn't that critically acclaimed? Didn't it win a Golden Globe, or didn't it win an Academy Award? I mean, how could it not have? Because it was truly a great film. And this is what Harry Medved told me in his own words. He said, well, John, Godzilla was on the ballot for best film of the year. And if you look, the nominees are one nominee short because there were always six nominees, but there were only five. And it turns out that the winner of the 1956 Academy Awards was Godzilla. And at that point, Motion Picture Academy of Arts and Sciences said, we can't do this. I mean, we're only 10 years out of World War II. And the horrible things that happened that were done by the Japanese to our soldiers, we just couldn't, or they couldn't allow Godzilla to win. So they pulled it. And because of that, Marty, the great film starring Ernest Borgnine, won the Academy Award, but it really didn't. The winner of the Academy Award and the winner of Best Actor was Raymond Burr and Godzilla. So that's what I was told by Harry Medved. Now, Harry's up there in that great film studio in the sky now, but that's what I was told. And he had no reason to lie to me and tell me something like that that wouldn't be the truth. And that would be like, here's an example. I came up with one. Suppose that we had the film industry back in 1850. Suppose it were there and we were making feature films. And suppose in 1875, which would have been 10 years after the Civil War ended, there was a company that created a film called Song of the South, the epic Disney film Song of the South. And now today, we all look at that film and we say, God, Disney has to be the most embarrassed of anything else when they talk about the happy slaves dancing around the campfire and Joel Chandler Harris, the young boy. I mean, that is the single most embarrassing moment in all of movie history. But think, if that had happened in 1875, only 10 years after the Civil War, we couldn't have lived with that being the best film. We just couldn't, as in our country. And I believe that's what they were thinking when they were talking about, you know, Godzilla can't win this award, and neither can Raymond Burr, because that's what Harry Medvin told me. He said, number one, Raymond Burr won Best Actor, and number two, best film was Godzilla. So when you're looking at that film, you're looking at one of the great films of all time, because it really did win an Academy Award, but they couldn't allow it to happen. It's not racist. I think it was a sign of the times. Now, anybody can say what they want, but this was told to me by Harry Medved, who was an employee of the Screen Actors Guild, and he knew what he was talking about. So I'm pleased that on July the 6th, 1990, that I had that conversation with him, and I wrote just a little note about Godzilla Oscar. That's all I wrote, and I didn't realize. I thought everybody knew that, but apparently they didn't. So do we have any comments? I know, Trey, you're the kind of guy that might make a comment about something like that.
Well, I think it's absolutely probably honest. My father-in-law was a Marine in the Pacific in World War II. And after the war, he would never consider buying a Japanese car, which is just, I mean, he said, I could never buy a Japanese car because of his experiences in World War II in the Pacific with Japanese. So I think Japanophobia that occurred after the war would be enough to say, if we proclaim a Japanese film as an award-winning film, people might just kind of boycott it because it was Japanese. I wonder what the box office tallies would look like. I don't think they did statistics quite the same way we would do them today, but I think that's probably very correct. And I think it was probably a business decision why they did that as much as a social decision. But social decision making was driving profitability, and that's what it's all about.
Well, you know, that's true. And when I was looking at the list of Academy Award nominees, Sal Mineo was nominated for Rebel Without a Cause. And it's amazing, with all the history that he had and the fact that he was murdered and everything, it's unbelievable. We probably had a lot of that going on. And I'm going to ask each one of our panelists to weigh in, and then finally John LeMay, because I think this is an important thing. Todd Saxon, what do you think about this decision and this story? I know you're a man with a lot of good opinion.
Well, I think maybe one of the people involved in the production and the special effects, if anybody actually knew who he was on a bigger level, A.G. Tsuburaya, he specialized in miniatures and did a propaganda film for the Imperial government during World War II that recreated the attack on Pearl Harbor. So that would be kind of hard for the public at the time to accept. But it's amazing for a guy that started doing some of those things. He created his own art form with building the miniatures in a whole different style as opposed to doing stop motion. I'm going to throw that one out there, gentlemen.
Wow. Very interesting. Very interesting. Thank you on that. Devin Tate, what do you think about this whole scenario?
Well, I'm not too familiar with it, but I liked your telling of the story. And, you know, I'll just say, you know, because I have some familiarity with the, you know, Oscars and the Emmys and the award shows, it's, you know, it gets very political and very complicated. But, you know, you also have to remember a lot of the people that make the decisions are old timers that have been, you know, around for a long time. So they may not be as, you know, they may be more cautious than the average moviegoer. So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me at all.
Right, and you had, back in that time, you had the MPAA, Motion Picture Association of America, that was very tough on films. I mean, they were tough on Ed Wood, you know, the self-proclaimed master of cinema. I mean, they almost didn't let Glenn or Glenda get seen by the public. So, I mean, there was a lot out there. They had a lot of things to be worried about. They were thrilled with Judy Garland and Fred Astaire. But I mean, you know, not everything was Judy Garland and Fred Astaire and Easter Parade. It just wasn't. So we had a lot of problems and a lot of issues. And John LeMay, because you're our guest, you get the final weigh in on this. What do you think about this entire scenario? And please fill us in some more on the Godzilla franchise, because you're our expert. You've got some great books out, so the floor is yours, kind sir.
Well, first, I'm just going to say I was really impressed with everything Todd said about AG Super Eye, because he's exactly right, and I'm not used to too many other people kind of outside of the Godzilla fandom knowing all that, so I mean that was nice to hear. Totally correct. Now as to your story, your friend's story, this is what I really believe happened. You know, people, and this is happening to me already, when you're really busy and you have a lot of projects under your belt, they all just blur together. So when your friend told you that story, and I'm so sorry, I know he's important, but I already forgot his name. What was it?
Harry Medved. He and his brother, yes, Michael Medved, were, you know, they were authors, and they worked out in Hollywood. And he just told me, pardon?
Oh, I was going to say, I really truly believe Harry Medved was misremembering something, and I don't know if this is true either, but this is what I think is more likely, is Godzilla, the Japanese version, was a rave critical success. I mean, I think it was like second only to Seven Samurai for many years for Japanese critics and audiences. You know, it was one of those seminal films. But I feel like what's more likely is that the Japanese version of Godzilla might have got nominated for maybe Best Foreign Picture in 1955 or something. Because I do find it kind of hard to believe that the Academy would consider Godzilla King of the Monsters for Best Picture, just because I thought that, like, the Best Picture usually had to be... Although I guess foreign films can be nominated for Best Picture. Can they? They don't have to be an American-made film.
Well, they can, because I remember the first one that actually was nominated for a film was called Black and White in Color, and it was an African film. It was a great film. I mean, it was shot in French. I mean, it's like we saw it in college, and we all thought it was great. We all knew a little bit of French. But, yeah, there was, but it didn't win. But, yes, there were foreign films. And I'm trying to think there was one. There was a big one that won Best Picture. I just can't remember it. We'll
yeah,
come
think,
up with it sometime.
I think it was last year, John. I think it was Parasite. I believe that was last year.
Yes.
Oh, that's true.
Yes, you're
right. Yeah, I think it's way more likely that it was the Japanese version of Godzilla nominated maybe for best foreign film. I just find it so hard to believe that they would consider Godzilla King of the Monsters for best picture, but in either case, I am going to include that story in the updated version of my book, because I have a whole book on the different edits of the Godzilla movies called Editing Japanese Monsters. So when I do an updated edition, I'm definitely going to include that story, though. And that's why I say when someone says it, you know, I mean, it doesn't really matter if you can prove it. It just matters that they said it, you know, and they believed it.
Well, I figure I was told by someone who was very credible. I have the date of the conversation, the time of the conversation, and I have the conversation and notes about it. So, I think it's got enough credibility that it at least and thank you very much, it at least deserves a little bit of attention. How about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I hope it's one of those things where I hope it's true, and I don't think he was lying to you, but I mean, that's why I stand. He might have been like misremembering, and it might have just simply been maybe it was up for best foreign picture and they didn't want it to win, but who knows? Who knows?
And, you know, not to politicize it, but it could have been fake news. Now, I watched Ironsides when I was a kid, and I remember Perry Mason. I remember the song, and I can still hear the song in my mind. But I didn't really know much about Raymond Burr. So I'm cruising on Wikipedia tonight to read about Raymond Burr, and he was asked to be on the show 30 years later, and he said he kind of liked Godzilla, and he said, you know, it'd be cool to be 30 years later back on the movie. But when you look at Raymond Burr's biographical contradictions, this is what I'm reading from Wikipedia, it says he was homosexual. And they did a lot of intentional misreporting. They said he was dating Natalie Wood. And he had the production companies would have him positioned with women publicly, so he would be to the public as a heterosexual, because they thought it would be bad if he turned out to be homosexual in the 1950s, and that he hid his homosexuality to protect his career. So it could have been some of behind the scenes manipulation by production companies to drive business. I think it all relates to profitability. So if you have a guy who's portraying something in a movie, and if it came out that he was homosexual, and if that would affect the box office, then they would probably do whatever's in their power to make sure that was confused and not readily apparent to the public. So by misinformation, they created different narratives to so it wouldn't affect the commercial success of a film. Who knows?
Right, and I want to add something. This is a very important story in that same vein. James Dean was in a car wreck, but there are certain reports that state that he did not die. Well,
sure.
The problem was that he was disfigured. Well, what does a movie company do that has in the can Giant, starring James Dean and Elizabeth Taylor, and has Rebel Without a Cause in the can with James Dean and Sal Mineo? They've got two of the biggest films of all time sitting in the can, and they can't let James Dean be seen disfigured. So a very strong story. And I believe it's a very strong story, is that they just put him in a cabana, gave him all the drugs he wanted, and he died 6 years later. And I somehow don't feel that that's a lie. I feel that there's enough seriousness in that, and there's enough seriousness in the way movie companies looked at profitability, that I think that it might have been true. So, you know, there's a lot to that kind of thing. I mean, you know, the Paul McCartney thing. Many of us are satisfied that Paul McCartney died and that they hired a dude named Billy Shears. And he was actually a better musician and a better songwriter than Paul McCartney. And the Beatles never would comment about that, but, you know, they did their little things like the Abbey Road cover and whatever. You know, there are a lot of things that have to do with profitability and the movie business and the entertainment business. I mean, right now, okay, I'm not gonna go into American Idol, and I'm not gonna go into Britain's Got Talent. There's a whole raft of things there, but you know, it is interesting what they'll do, and who we've got as the stars today. So, John LeMay, please continue. I'm sorry, I had to get that one in there tonight. It was very important to me. And then when you rewrite your book or your chapter, you can please listen to this show and get some of the things that we've said. So I'm going to turn it back over to you, my friend.
Well, I'm glad you did, because I wanted to hear the story again in depth, and I'm really glad you brought up the James Dean thing, because I knew nothing about that. And I love the stories that this or that celebrity didn't actually die. I'm like the new one right now is JFK Jr. They say he's secretly alive, but let's not go down that rabbit hole. Let's go back to Godzilla. But so yeah, Godzilla King of the Monsters, like I said, huge hit. They even put up a plaque outside the studios where they shot Raymond Burr's new scenes. I think in 2006 they erected a plaque. So I'm trying to find my source for where that was. Let's see. It was a place called Visual Drama Incorporated. And I believe it was in Los Angeles. But the current day site is Frank Del Olmo Elementary School. So I don't know if Devin would be familiar with that or not, but that's where Raymond Burr shot all his scenes. And something else interesting about Raymond Burr, you know, he carries that whole American cut, but he shot all of his footage in, I think, just 1 or 2 days, and that was it. That entire movie, just 1 or 2 days, barely slept because he just wanted to get it done. So that's really interesting.
Just wanted to get it done. My goodness. Why?
I don't know. Maybe he was on a time crunch for something else, but yeah, he wanted to get it done, and so it was either 1 day or 2 days or something like that.
And maybe he just despised the project. That could have been
I believe what Trey said, though, because I've heard that same quote before, that he actually liked Godzilla, and I think if he really did despise the project, I don't think he would have come back for Godzilla 1985, you know, 30 years later, in which he played that same character. And what was funny, you know, again, his character's name was Steve Martin, and by, you know, the time 1985 rolled around, everybody associated him with a comedian, so in Godzilla 1985, he's never referred to as Steve Martin. He's referred to only as Mr. Martin, because they didn't want people to snicker.
Right.
Well, you know, movies are pretend, and they pretend to be real. So you'd think that a lot of the action goes on is to create those illusions and to make sure that commercially there is success.
Yep, and what's obvious is, even though King of the Monsters was such a big success, is that the people who bought the rights to the sequel, you know, in Japan, the sequel to Godzilla came out within 6 months, and it was called Godzilla Raids Again. And the people who bought it, it was really strange. They didn't want it to be a Godzilla movie. They wanted to do the same thing they had done on King of the Monsters and bring in new American actors. And they actually wanted to change Godzilla into a T-Rex. That, you know, the Godzilla from Godzilla Raids Again, they were going to say was just a basic giant T-Rex, and they didn't want to call him Godzilla. The movie was called The Volcano Monsters. And the guy who wrote Volcano Monsters, I don't know if anybody's familiar with his name is Ib Melchior, and he wrote The Angry Red Planet, and he wrote Reptilicus. Does anybody remember those movies?
Definitely Angry Red Planet, yes, sir.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, in other words, he wrote some real throwaways.
Yeah, but and the only reason I brought it up is so they decided not to change Godzilla Raids again into the volcano monsters. And Ib Melchior, he held on to his volcano monster script, and when they asked him to write Reptilicus in 1961, he basically took that script and took the same characters and kind of similar events in a way, and he managed to concoct Reptilicus from this discarded American Godzilla movie, which was just some odd trivia. But back to Godzilla Raids Again, once they decided not to do the volcano monsters, they decided, well, we'll just dub it into English. But the weird thing was they still didn't want to call it Godzilla, so they renamed Godzilla Gigantic. And nobody to this day knows why they did it. Some people think that they were afraid if they used the Godzilla name, they would get sued by the U.S. producers of Godzilla King of the Monsters, which is kind of silly because Toho owned Godzilla, and you would think Toho would want a Godzilla movie to be called Godzilla and continue the brand. But anyways, a lot of kids, and when that movie came out in 1959, were very confused because they recognized the monster on screen as Godzilla, but it was called Gigantic. And it wasn't really a big hit either.
It's very interesting when you talk about the branding of Godzilla. I've got a local story that I happen to know of because I am from the Carolinas and I ran Comic-Cons. There was a nice fella, and he had a business called That Godzilla Guy, and he sold Godzilla products. And he got a letter from Toho Films, and this was about 6 years ago, so it would have been about 2015, that said cease and desist. You can't use the name That Godzilla Guy. And, you know, you're talking about a guy that's in front of maybe 2,000 people a year, and they get on him for using the name That Godzilla Guy. It's like, why are they so upset about something so small when you're talking about major events like films and using the name Godzilla and it was used by someone else? Isn't it just amazing what their priorities are?
Overzealous. Yeah, they're overzealous. Like, for instance, Subway did a $5 footlong commercial with like a kind of like a dinosaur crouncing through a city, and Toho went after them for that, which I think was totally uncalled for because a giant dinosaur is not, you know, Godzilla. That was a bit much. But yeah, and that is why I will never write a book with Godzilla's name in the title. But I mean, I do Japanese monster books that talk about, you know, all of them, because Toho wasn't the only ones in the game. There was also a studio called Daiei Studios. And in 1965, they did a movie called Gamera about a giant flying turtle.
It was pretty really successful idea, series there as well, sir.
Yeah. Yeah, and it had the same thing, same treatment as Godzilla King of the Monsters, because Gamera had an all-Japanese cast in Japan, but when they imported it to America, they added in, like, Albert Dekker and Brian Don Levy from, I think it was a Quartermass Experiment. So same exact thing with Gamera, and it became Gamera the Invincible. But I have a feeling that Todd wants to talk more about Gamera because it's so crazy. Am I right?
Well, no. Actually, a couple things got going in there on that one. There was one of Gamera's foes has a name where there's just like a vowel difference or something like that. The same name as one of the Toho monsters. Actually, the background, the one with the floppy ears that fought Frankenstein.
Yeah, there's Baragon with an A and Barugon with an E.
Baragon, yeah, Baragon. And yet there was one, Gamera, I believe, fought a Baragon, slightly different spelling, before that Baragon. I just thought that was interesting. And then with the name protection, what kind of Greek did Blue Oyster Cult do?
I have always wondered how Blue Oyster Cult got away with that song and if they paid a licensing fee or what, but I have no idea.
Just.
It just makes you laugh, doesn't it? What are those people thinking of over there in Tokyo All they're thinking about is eating raw fish. Now you say, you know it.
Man, that's, well, you know, Dr. John, you know about using the phrase Comic-Con.
Oh, yeah, but we got one. You can't
so now we have to use C-O-M-I-C-O-N. We can't use C-O-M-I-C-O-N, even though there's a dash in the middle of it, because some crazy court said you can't do it. So we had to go rename all of our events, and that's why I'm kind of afraid to do a Comic-Con. That's why I do Lizard Man Festival and Bigfoot Festival and things like that. I don't want to get involved in all.
Oh, John, I can one up you. You're going to like this. I can one up you. Okay, Roswell had their own Comic-Con, but they never called it Comic-Con. They did a really intelligent play on words. They should have been able to get away with this. It's so wrong. Roswell had Cosmic-Con. Not Comic-Con, Cosmic-Con, which is perfect because, you know, cosmos, space, you know, that's a cute name.
Sure.
It's cool. And Comic-Con went after them. They're like, oh, you can't do Cosmic-Con. So it became Galacticon, which is, it, you know, Galacticon is pretty cool too, but Cosmic-Con was just perfect, you know, and it just, I don't know.
It was perfect,
that's where
absolutely.
You make yourself unlikable when you do that. You know, there's protecting your brand, but when you go overboard like that, it's just, it's detestable.
When you're so big and you do something like that, it just becomes stupid. I mean, it really does. And there are a lot of fans that look at that and say it's stupid. And it's a non-profit anyway. It's not like a for-profit thing. It's a non-profit. And, I mean, it's just, they're crazy. And it makes you not want to like them, but that's just... Sorry, that's just me, and I can say that, you know. It's just amazing at what people can do. But, yeah, you know, we've covered so many topics. I mean, the topic of Godzilla just reaches out to so many areas, from James Dean to Sal Mineo to Raymond Burr to the Hollywood Hills. I mean, it just really does. And I think that says something about Godzilla. It's universal. Godzilla is in the realm of Frankenstein and Dracula. And I would say it's part of the top three. Now, does anyone agree or disagree with me? I think Godzilla is one of the top three.
It's definitely one of the longest-running franchises it's ever been. I know I saw some stat on it back a couple of years ago. One of the longest-running franchises. That's saying something.
So yeah, there's more Godzillas than there are James Bond films, and there's quite a few James Bonds as well.
Yeah, there may be more films, but duration from 55?
Or 54 in Japan.
Is Dracula 1931 and Frankenstein 31-32. Those have to be the only longer running franchises in all of movie history. And then Godzilla is probably third. It's great
and
stuff.
Frankenstein is actually are kind of cheating because they're in public domain. So, I mean, you and I could make a Frankenstein and Dracula movie and not get in trouble. You know, so they kind of have that advantage where there's more films for them just because of that. But yeah, like Godzilla and James Bond, there can only be official adaptations. There can't be, you know, people just thinking they can make a Godzilla movie and get away with it. Because I think back in the late 70s, this Hong Kong studio was going to make a King Kong and Godzilla movie called Star Godzilla, and they had the cast ready to go, and they were advertising it in Variety. Toho naturally shut them down, which that I understand because, you know, it was a movie. It wasn't just a little, you know, thing. And I will say this for Toho, too. In the last 5 years, since they sent your friend that letter, they've kind of cooled off. I think they've quit shooting themselves in the foot. I think they realized they're becoming very unpopular with the fans, and it probably was not worth what they were paying their lawyer. They go after these little tiny people, you know, because it probably, some of them, I mean, let's say you go after an author of a self-published book that had Godzilla in it, Toho would probably spend more money on their lawyers than the author ever made in terms of royalties. You know what I'm saying? So I think they finally realized that. Now they're just like, well, it's free publicity, and I think they only go after the really big stuff now.
Bingo. Bingo. Free publicity, and they're moving their product through them.
Yeah.
Another factor is that if you have a trademark or a service mark on a name or an image, if you do not protect it, then you've, I think, legally abandoned it. So what they might be doing is they might figure, well, let's try to protect our mark so we can show we're protecting our mark, but rather than push against a big player who have their own lawyers, we'll just go against people who are self-published or have done this or don't have two nickels to rub together to spend a big legal defense, and they'll back off, and then we can say, well, we protected our trademark name, our service mark name. And you can see in these examples, we've sent the cease and desist letters, and they cease and desist. Maybe there's some legal aspect of it that causes people to do that.
I'll buy that.
A size thing about how big someone is. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
so let's pick on little guys
because
we know we're going to steamroll them. And but if they went against Disney, then Disney, who certainly does a lot of protected material protection, you know, maybe they would choose to pick a fight with them, and then it turned out to be a very expensive proposition.
Well, probably Disney would just buy Toho Films. I mean,
yeah. Right.
They could buy Toho Films and not even think a thing about it. Yeah.
You know what I think is amazing, though, is here we're talking about Godzilla and King Kong, and this stuff has been going around since the 30s, right?
King Kong.
Yes, King Kong. I mean, King Kong, 1932.
Okay. Let me see if I can figure this out. 19. So let's see. I'm going to look something up on the computer.
Well,
you guys take it away.
Well,
I'll bring my point up in a second when I look this up.
What
okay.
You just did
okay. Here
is you just shot. You just shot me in the foot about King Kong being not the third longest running franchise. I believe King Kong is the third longest running franchise. There you go. So thank
okay,
you.
Okay, let
for
me ask you this question. Do you know who Charles Curtis is?
That name
really
rings a bell.
Well, he was the 31st vice president of these United States of America, 1929 to 1933. Now, I don't know who Charles Curtis is. You asked me who Charles Curtis is. I said, well, I don't know. From the 30s. Here's a vice president from the 30s. And you asked me who King Kong and Godzilla are, and you're going to go, yeah, I know those guys. So what I think that really does say something to, you know, here is fictitious information, but in such a compelling storyline, you can't forget them. Charles Curtis, no offense, but not so much.
Charlie,
let's see
you're in third place.
Well, you know, we could,
I'm
the
sorry.
Rights to Kong are a bigger mess. Godzilla, I mean, the rights to Godzilla aren't a mess. They're just kind of contentious, but now, the rights to King Kong is a cluster you-know-what, because back in 1933, you know, people weren't really savvy to franchises yet. Marion C. Cooper, he created King Kong, and he just thought, oh, I created King Kong, but he didn't ever stop to think, yeah, I created King Kong, but RKO released the film. So you had Marion Cooper thinking he created Kong, RKO believed they created Kong. Willis O'Brien, the animator, he also felt like he created King Kong because in 1958, he started his own movie called King Kong versus Frankenstein. And because he also loved Frankenstein, and he just thought, you know, I'm Willis O'Brien. I animated King Kong. They're not going to give me any trouble. And lo and behold, you know, RKO basically tells Willis O'Brien, no, you can't make this movie. We own Kong, and if you want Kong, you have to pay $220,000 for the rights, which he didn't have. So poor Willis O'Brien gets involved with this swindler producer named John Beck. And John Beck's like, okay, Obie, I'll find a studio to make this King Kong versus Frankenstein. And all the studios in the U.S. turned him down. Again, this was probably 1961 by now. Project had been in the works for a while. And so Beck, he's aware of Toho in Japan. He's like, well, they make giant monster movies. I'm going to see if they want to pay $220,000 to make King Kong versus Frankenstein. And Beck doesn't even tell poor old Willis O'Brien he's in Japan. And Toho's like, yeah, we want to make a King Kong movie. We'll pay $220,000, but we're going to swap out Frankenstein for Godzilla. And that is how King Kong versus Godzilla came to be. And it's a fun movie, but the sad part of it that a lot of people don't realize is Willis O'Brien didn't realize that his King Kong versus Frankenstein movie was dead until he saw in the papers that they were making King Kong versus Godzilla. And he got so depressed, he actually had a heart attack and died not too long after that. And a lot of people, including his wife, Darlene, really think that just the crushing disappointment of basically having his project stolen by John Beck and turned into a Godzilla movie, you know, it did him in the end. So that's kind of the sad, dark side of King Kong versus Godzilla from 1962.
You know, when we see a Godzilla movie, when we see a King Kong movie, all we're doing is looking at the tip of the iceberg. All the stuff that's going on under it, the history, the culture, and you know, I still am fascinated by the fact that the Godzilla is a sea creature, a sea dinosaur that becomes irradiated and turns into the monster. So when you add in that layer of social influence and angst over the atomic bomb in Japan, mm-hmm. What you see is just the tip of the surface, and all this other stuff. It's fascinating to look into the behind the screen image, literally the behind the screen image of what these iconic movies are and what they really represent, the people that were behind it, the different theories, and who eventually got, I mean, I can tell you who has the rights for Godzilla. It's whoever designs the lunch boxes. They have to know, you know, who to get permission in order to design a Godzilla lunchbox. That's a quick and easy way to figure out who controls it. You just talk to the lunchbox people and say who'd you get permission from to put Godzilla on your lunchbox.
And again, back to Kong, nobody knew who owned him for quite a few years because throughout the 1960s, Marion Cooper and RKO had this legal battle, again, where Marion Cooper felt like, hey, I own King Kong and you don't. And he kind of found a loophole because Cooper had done a King Kong novelization in, at the time of the film's release. And the funny thing was Cooper, technically, he owned the rights to that novelization, so he could still – so Cooper has made a remake of King Kong based off of the novelization and gotten away with it, but he couldn't do – his own original King Kong like productions, and that this whole thing didn't get settled until 1977, around the time King Kong remake came out. They had a big there was actually two different King Kong remakes in development at the same time, and it was just that Dino De Laurentiis' version actually won, but Universal was working on their own King Kong called The Legend of King Kong. And their version was actually going to be set in 1933. It would have been a much more faithful remake, but just those legalities were so hard to figure out. And what ended up happening was, this is kind of funny, Marion C. Cooper's son Richard finally won the legal battle with RKO in 1976-77. He got the rights to Kong unequivocally. And then he turned around right away and sold them to Universal Studios. And that's why in the 90s you would see the Universal King Kong ride. That's why they had the Universal remake in 2005. So Universal basically owns the film rights to King Kong, and then the Cooper Estate owns, like, print rights. So that's why King Kong is kind of confusing when it comes to rights.
So, John, what I'm hearing is that the person that really owns financially the biggest profit margin in all of these movies are the lawyers.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point.
Indeed.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
You guys brought up some neat stuff, though. Like, given how that stuff was happening in the 70s with King Kong, anybody even remember that there was another King Kong movie, King Kong Lives?
Oh, I love that movie. That's actually one of my favorites, which people think I'm crazy, but yeah, I love it.
I think the story was great. I just, you know, it's just one of those ones. It seemed to, I hate to say it, but it kind of slipped by me a little bit. And I'm such a general kaiju genre sucker. That's just the way it is for me. You were talking about, would you say Marlon Cooper, something like that, the guy that had done the original stop-motion stuff with King Kong?
Yes,
the
Cooper
when
was
he was working with Toho Studios, they were never going to take the time and effort to do a stop-motion movie to begin with.
No.
That was never going to happen. Toho was never going to make an investment like that.
No.
And something else I wanted to touch on that Dr. Troy brought up was the original Godzilla, what it was coming out of, you know, the birth of the atomic age, how it had impacted and things. There was not just a black and white film set, but there was definitely a dark edginess about that movie, and I think maybe Toho Next had that same kind of edginess in the original Rodan movie. But there was definitely it was a kind of heavy flick when it came out. It was very heavy.
Yeah, but King Kong vs. Godzilla was, like, very light. But it was also, in 1962, at that time, it was the most successful Japanese film of all time, which is pretty impressive.
Wow.
Well, lest we not forget the effect of Godzilla on the music video industry. At one point in time, the biggest number one music video of all time was Intergalactic, Interplanetary by the Beastie Boys, and it was a Godzilla spoof. Huh. I mean, Godzilla is all over. Do we all remember Intergalactic, Interplanetary, as they called it? It was a genius thing, and it was like. It's like, what more can you say? Godzilla permeates our culture. It is, I mean, I guess, okay, I will recant everything that I said, and I'll say the biggest franchises are Godzilla, Frankenstein, Dracula, and King Kong. Those are the four biggest, and if you look, three of them come from the early 30s, and then we've got Godzilla that came from the mid-50s, I guess. Who knows? It might have come sooner. But I don't know. But those are the things that we as a culture love, and we think about, and I think they're great. We love them. There's no one on this podcast that doesn't love those. If you are on this podcast and you don't love them, and you don't speak now, then forever hold your peace. Nobody spoke. It's great. Who laughed?
I got nothing. I'm a shill for those things.
Okay. Dr. Trey?
What's that?
Any comment? Any comments?
Now I'm reading about stop motion and how that came to be and the different I am no film person. I mean, I like watching movies and I don't think about them. I just enjoy them. In the 1970s, all I was trying to do is get through college and medical school. I didn't watch anything. So,
I know.
When I get on this podcast, this radio show, I just learn all sorts of things that I had no exposure to. So I'm just fascinated by all of it, and I'm fascinated by the fact that, you know, here we're talking about something that's going on 90 years old and it's still a phenomenon, which is pretty darn cool.
Right.
Yeah, that is a great statement. 90 years old and still cruising and bruising. It really is. It's kind of like professional wrestling. It's still cruising and bruising. And Devin,
yeah, I've worked as a with a lot of historical groups. I still do with Revolutionary War reenactment. We put on a yearly program in Camden, and you ask some kids that are coming through for tours, does the year 1776 mean anything to you? And they look at you like deer in the headlights, you know? And but I bet if I could ask, do you know who King Kong is? They go, yeah. So there you go. It's just
right.
It's very interesting.
And you just mentioned something that's very important, and I picked up on it, and the fact is, in 2031, that will be the 100th anniversary of the great and immortal Dracula. And I guess we better get started now for the celebration so that we can have it over there in dear old Camden, right?
Well, I'm not sure if that's true, John. I mean, how old was Dracula when he got to in 1931? I mean, wasn't he a couple hundred years old?
No, 1880 something. Bram Stoker. But the whole.
No, no. But how old was Dracula in 1931?
Oh,
I mean, wasn't he already a couple hundred years old? So you know, he's probably a couple hundred year old plus a hundred in 1931.
And are we counting Nosferatu as that? As part of
We are counting everything that is fun because this is Scary Cast, and we have a grand time talking about what we do. And John LeMay gets us excited about some of this incredible stuff. Now, I mean, you know, I don't know what to say. I was wanting to ask Devin because he's our man in Hollywood, and he has got his thumb on the pulse of Dracula, King Kong, Frankenstein, and Godzilla, and the whole bunch. And Devin, what is the pulse in Hollywood of these classic monsters? That's a terrible terrible question. I just come out of the blue and ask you the most in-depth question of all time.
No, I think this any of those kind of timeless classic stories that, you know, people from different generations can relate to them, and they've been, you know, the stories have been told again and placed in new contexts, new time periods, and so they've been able to, you know, reach out to people of all different types, you know. So I think, you know, unfortunately Hollywood does have a tendency to recycle things, so sometimes it's recycling, but I think other times a lot of them have had really thought-provoking, cool, new versions, you know, or new stories told using those old characters and the classic storyline. So I think as long as people can kind of riff on those and come up with new ways to tell those stories, they're going to be with us for a long time, you know, probably for generations and generations after we're gone.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's nothing compelling like a great story. You give a great story, and it's a great story now, and it's a great story 90 years ago, and 90 years from now, a good story is a good story.
Exactly.
That's right. And I have two great takeoffs on vampires. I'm hoping that I can get them done before I die. So yes, we all love these things. And John LeMay, I guess you're our guide. You're the man that brought these four characters to light tonight by discussing Godzilla. And I have been in love with my buddies, Godzilla, King Kong, Dracula, and Frankenstein, since I was 5 years old. So John LeMay, cap off our evening of discussion about these great characters. I don't care if they're bad guys. They're our heroes. So tell us about our heroes and why do we love them?
So I would say all of the monsters, maybe except for Dracula, eventually turned sympathetic. Because, you know, Godzilla turned, he started out as a bad guy. And then on his fifth film, which was called Ghidorah, the Three-Headed Monster, he teamed up with Mothra. He saw Mothra getting beat up by this dragon from outer space, and he felt sorry for her. And he teamed up with Mothra to fight Giga the Space Dragon, and he became a hero. And he's been a hero off and on ever since, you know, so he became a King Kong, totally unsympathetic in his first film. I mean, there's kind of some sympathy, but I mean, he's pretty vicious. He bites people in half. If you actually watch the film, he bites people and grinds the natives into the earth. You really shouldn't feel too sorry for King Kong, and yet audiences did. They loved him. They felt sorry for him. So you'll notice that only in the first film is King Kong portrayed as kind of a bad guy, and in all of the sequels follow. He's always been a good guy. You know, you always felt sorry for him because you've got Fay Wray just screaming away in the original film. Then when you got to Jessica Lange, you know, she liked King Kong because audiences liked King Kong. You know, so it's interesting to see how the audience opinions of the characters really changed them. And again, to a lesser extent, Frankenstein Monster, kind of just a bad guy in the first one, but then in Bride of Frankenstein, you kind of feel sorry for him, and then he ends the movie a hero because he's the one who blows up the castle. So, yeah, they are heroes in odd ways, except for maybe Dracula. I don't think he's ever – he's always been pretty much a straight-up bad guy, I would say. But, he, you know, he's likable. He's a charming bad guy, you know. you know what? Okay, here's what I'm going to say about Dracula that's interesting. You've got James Bond, who in every movie he's the hero who fights a new villain. But with Dracula, it's the opposite. Dracula is always the villain, but the hero is the guest star. Whereas, you know, usually it's the hero is the star and the villain's the guest. Kind of interesting.
Well, I've got something interesting to share with everybody. First of all, one of the greatest vampires was Susan Sarandon, and she played with David Bowie in The Hunger. And that was one of the greatest vampire films of all time. My dad took me to see it. He said, I heard it was scary and good, and I know you like vampires, so I'm going to take you to see it. So, you know, that is one interesting take on vampires. She was a bad girl. She was really a bad girl. And she put her former lovers into coffins, and she wouldn't get them out. And then I will say that I do have an interesting distinction. Because we know that Bela Lugosi played the vampire in 1931. And for a period of a year and a half, I got to room with Bela Lugosi IV. It was like one of the greatest years and a half that I ever had. We watched Plan 9 from Outer Space every weekend. I heard all the stories about why the Lugosi family doesn't like Ed Wood. It was amazing. I mean, you know, I've had one of the greatest childhoods in history, even though the childhood lasted until it was probably yesterday, okay? But it was just wonderful, and yes, you're right. The vampires, they're never good guys, but we somehow like them, you know? But anyway, so I want to say thank you, John. You have, as usual, you have brought about the most interesting discussions that we ever have on ScaryCast. And can we you have been coming every first Monday of the month for about 6 months, 7 months. Will you come back? We got to have you. Will you come back, please?
I think we had more fun talking about this than we did the cowboys and aliens and the dinosaurs. And well, we've got plenty of film stuff we can talk about whenever y'all want. So,
well, I'm sure we'll have a great time the next time you come back, which will be the first Monday in May. So that's going to be a lot of fun. I want to thank our panelists tonight. You have been absolutely wonderful. Our guest from Pop Culture Stars, Todd Saxon. Todd, you're always welcome to come here. We're glad to have you here. Dr. Trey Donaway, the Surgeon General of ScaryCast. You're just a blast. You bring a really interesting perspective to what we do. Devin Tate, you are our man from Hollywood, and thank you for being exactly that. And I feel like I have forgotten some. Have I forgotten anyone? No one.
That's everybody.
No one
yet.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's
good.
No one yelled, so I didn't forget anyone. And all I got to say is, that's right. That's how I have to do it now. If no one yells, then I didn't forget. But anyway, John LeMay, you're the best. Thank you so much. You're our wonderful property on the first Monday night. You're a lot of fun to have, and we want you back forever. So thanks a lot. And everybody on WLSC AM and FM, we're so glad to have you on ScaryCast.com, which is the podcast. We're so glad to have you. Send us a comment, send us a text, send us whatever, and we'll see you next week. Now, next week, we have Matt Perry of the Vulnerability Podcast, and Vulnerability is Cool. The next week, we have Robin McCray. She will be doubling as not only a co-host, but she will also be a guest, and she and Devin Tate are working on a show, and it's going to be a blast. So please join us every week, 9 p.m. Monday nights on the podcast, and it runs forever. And then also join us at WLSC AM and FM midnight, the witching hour, on Saturday night. And thanks so much for being with us. This is Dr. John live from Myrtle Beach. And we've had a great time. Thanks to our panel. Thanks to our guest. And we'll see you next week on the one, the only ScaryCast. Cheers.
Take care of yourselves, everyone.